Hey everyone, it's Adam. So today we prepared an episode designed for people who are new to the SaaS industry or who are looking to break into SaaS. What do you need to know as a CX professional coming in? Now, unfortunately, my mic quality in this episode is super low. I know I've apologized for this before, but I think we recorded this in the same session as the previous episode that had this problem. So still working on it, and I will keep you updated on my ability to properly use a microphone. Until then, enjoy the show.
Hey Dee.
Hey Adam.
Question for you.
Ask away.
What are all these terms in SaaS, and what do I really need to know about them if I want to work in SaaS?
Great question. Let's get into it. What is this?
Okay, CXetera, where we
Talk about the future of CX and
a little bit more.
boom. Ns, ns,
I was going late night DJ voice, and you're at the club.
I'm
The
all
you're at the club, in fact.
blurb in my mind. I'm always at the club mentally.
Okay, well, the hottest club actually right now is, I was about to say the hottest club right now is B2B SaaS. I don't know if it is. The hottest club now, I guess, is like AI native companies.
So, but we are, I'm excited about this episode because we both get questions from folks who are interested in transitioning and coming into SaaS, either in similar roles from the industries that they're in or in complete career changes. And so in this little episode, we plan to talk about what it's like to work in SaaS. We demystify some common SaaS acronyms. And I think we'll maybe even if we've got the time, we'd give a tip or two. What do you say?
Okay, I love it. Should we maybe say what SAS stands for?
Let's start there.
I was just thinking about that. So SAS is not just the thing that we often give on this podcast. SAS is software as a service. We define that as basically being like the next generation of companies that came after the like on-premise software where someone actually needed to go like install the software on a server and deploy it locally, right? Like the idea of software as a service is it's in the cloud and you're always renewing your license, right? It's not something you buy one time and then buy again the next time some like new version comes out. So that's going to influence a lot of what we talk about today, because I think a lot of what is working in SaaS, and especially like what is working in SaaS for those of us who are doing anything related to the customer lifecycle, is making sure that because the customer can basically cancel or renew at any time, we really need to make sure that they're always going to renew and ideally are going to renew with even more of our product than they had before.
That's right. Yeah. And I think for a lot of folks who maybe went to school at the same, roughly the same time that Adam and I did, you might recall buying software at your, I don't know, college store in the form of CDs and things like that. And
It
you
was like
would
Sim Farm or something like that.
like I would like install all my Microsoft, $79 from the UT store instead of hundreds of dollars, whatever student software on my computer. And then if you lost the disk or you lost the code, you were kind of SOL.
Unless you knew how to pirate.
Right, unless you're pirating. And so, and then when we kind of graduated and we came out into the workforce in the mid-aughts or whatever, and people started to move from that format into this subscription model where everyone's paying and everything's in the cloud. So, you're not finagling around with CDs and various other things. But what that did really for businesses on the other side, as Adam mentioned, is also you had customer experience come about, and we were really charged as a function with making sure that when people did buy our software, whether it was monthly or annual subscription models or multi-year models, that the customers were getting a ton of value out of it so that they would renew that subscription model. So same thing, if you are a consumer and you have a Netflix subscription, there are, you might decide one month if you're paying month to month as a consumer, okay, Netflix doesn't have anything that I want to watch, so I'm going to cancel. That in the SaaS world is called a churn. So that's a common word that we use as
Or
well.
like if you don't churn, you renew.
Yeah, you renew. Or let's say that you downgraded to a lesser plan than you contracted, meaning that like you're paying less money for that subscription than you did.
Or downsell is the other term sometimes you hear for that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So like if you think about it that way, because the main difference between that and your Netflix account is that it's in B2B, at least like for consumer software, it still also kind of works that way, right? Like even if it's a SaaS product. In B2B, the issue is that it's an entire company that can decide to retain or to churn. And there are many different stakeholders at that company who could make that decision or could influence that decision. And that's kind of where the whole discipline of customer success came out of.
That's right. And, you know, so really like our world is about educating folks, making sure they get value out of that software, making sure that then not only the individuals but the teams and then the functions and then the like departments and then, you know, like all of the layers in an organization are using that software and getting a ton of value out of it and adopting it essentially. Because you know, the other danger that happens a lot, one of the dangerous things that keep people in SaaS up at night is that, hey, I just sold a great deal. Let's say I sold, you know, to this company of 5,000 people, I sold everybody in this company a license of my software. But now of those 5,000 people, only 500 are using it. That's not great for you, right? And so that's what keeps SaaS people up at night. We're constantly looking at what did we sell? What did the customer buy? What were their use cases? Which that is also a term that's very sassy, use cases.
Use case, yeah.
Yeah, is that one?
I think it's leaked. I think it's broken containment, but like what are you using the product for?
Yep. Yep. What's the primary?
Great. You could do it for different things. Yeah. And maybe one other just variant to put on it is that every product makes money in different ways. So there are some that are charging based on licenses, like you said, and they're monitoring the actual usage and whether those licenses are being consumed is really important. You need to look at the daily active users or monthly active users, DAOs, MAUs, all like that's how we would. Do you say MAU or do you say MAU?
But so both.
Personally,
yeah,
you say both?
I just depends on who I'm talking to. Like if they're using it, I don't mind using it. I like probably in my head, I think about it as MAU.
I think in my head, I think of them as MAUs these days, but
do you think about it as MAUs? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know why, but anyway, like that's what we're talking about, right? Like you need some metric that basically tells you like, is the customer using the product in the way that indicates that they're healthy, but also that like you're going to get paid for doing it. Whereas like other SaaS products, you might get paid based off of, hey, like you're just on this plan. And because you're on this plan, you have access to these features and you pay a flat fee based on that. And so then it's probably more important for you to monitor, is the customer using all of the features in their plan? Are they using those often? Do they have certain use cases that might be an indication that they should actually expand to a higher plan because they're doing stuff where they're like starting to hit the boundaries of what your tool does, right? So like that's kind of how those concepts tie together in my mind.
Yeah, that's super helpful. I love that you said that. There are many ways that companies make money, right, in the SaaS world. What's an interesting thing I think to note though is that that world is changing. So we've had a few decades now where people have said, okay, we're selling licenses to our software. And so we want people to initially activate that license, right? So that's usually an initial metric that you might look at for your, like if you're in customer success, you're going to look at that metric, right? Did they actually like activate it? Meaning did they sign in? You'd be surprised, dear readers, dear listeners, a lot of people actually won't. Like, well, your company is buying the software for you. They'll tell you that software exists, but you may never have a reason for it, or the use case may not be like that great for you. So you may not go in and activate your license.
Well, and especially like in the days where things like were very frothy and people just had a lot of money to throw around, you might have like the term is like the economic buyer is different from the end user of the product. And so you sold to one person and they're like, oh, that sounds like a great idea, but they didn't think about like how to actually implement it. And so then no one's using it.
Yeah. And also like you know, you also in large organizations, you have to, it's like a little country. Like how are you actually telling everyone in your town or your country or whatever that software is available for them to use, educating them on how they can use it and supporting that. Right. Because there's, you know, on average,
what do you use it for?
What do you use it for? And is it like, is it a habit across the organization, or are there pockets of that usage, right? So all of those things are challenges that customer experience people think about day in and day out. But essentially, that was the model for, or it has been and continues to be the prevailing model. It's like you activate the license and then you want, then you look at a frequency metric, which is what Adam was talking about with DAO, WOW, MAO. It's like daily active usage. You know, something like Slack, you probably want daily active usage, but something like, I don't know, so let's say an agile tool, you might be okay with weekly, you know, maybe not the daily standups. That's a bad example, but like, you know, there are other tools where weekly or monthly is enough. But you're going to look at those things as indicators of health, because if people are using your product frequency, then they're frequently, then they're more likely to renew. So that's been the prevailing model in SaaS. The big shift now, though, that's happening is that people are looking at outcomes-based pricing.
Which is so, super cool.
Which is really cool. And I think that is, those are the companies that are really paving the way, I think, for everybody else. That's the big shift in SaaS, I think. There's only a small handful of companies doing it. It's very, very difficult to kind of like pivot to that model if you're, depending on what your product is like. But to me, that's what I would look out for if you're looking at transitioning into SaaS, is look at the companies that are ahead of the game here and are already transitioning to that kind of model. Now, I'm not saying that makes sense for everybody to do. In a lot of, you know, sort of business cases, you might stay that way.
But yeah, it means your product has to have like a use case, like going back to the use case idea, like you have to have something that is a quantifiable outcome.
Yeah.
I work for a company that is HR tech software. It's not like, there's not like a success or failure rate of HR tech software, right? Like you're either able to manage your policies and your absences, or you're not. So there, like having a license-based model makes sense. Whereas like kind of AI chat support software, right? Where like this, if the software works, then the customer is not going to submit a support ticket and they are going to self-serve. And if it fails, they aren't. So then like outcomes-based pricing makes total sense.
Yep. Yep. And is incredibly, like, I think what you want is you want to have great product market fit, right? So people who that is solving a clear problem with your software, for your software solving a clear problem for them. And then you want to make sure that your pricing model is very customer centric, right? You don't want your customers to be penalized for using your product more. You want to make sure that, like, if they're not using what they paid for, that you're able to, you know, we call them like true ups or whatever, like every so often you're like, well, you're not using all this stuff, so let's actually not make you pay for it. You know, so there's a lot of stuff that goes into both types of models and managing that whole relationship and the like, what we call recurring revenue, right?
Yeah, let's talk about recurring revenue for a moment, because I think that's
helpful.
Oh, okay, you want me to say? Okay.
I do.
Let's talk about recurring revenue and revenue retention, because I think we could just kind of like quickly go through all of those. So ARR or MRR, depending on how your company measures, annual or monthly, you probably do both, but you probably talk about one of them more than the other, is basically like how much recurring revenue do you have, right? So like if you add up all of the subscriptions that the company has, or even like a customer can pay a certain amount in MRR or in ARR, basically tells you, first of all, how much is your business making on an ongoing basis from those licenses, but it can also tell you the size of a customer, right? Like a 10K MRR customer and a 10,000K MRR customer are very, very different in terms of the size and scope of what they're doing with your product. So that's like ARR, MRR. But then there's like this other side of revenue retention, right? And we were talking about churn and retention before. I think it probably makes sense to define those.
Sure. Okay. So we talked about, I'm going to back up a little bit. The whole thing that we're trying to communicate is that they're, like, this is all cyclical, right? So what you're doing as a company is you're trying to, what's known as acquiring a customer, right? If people who watch Shark Tank, they talk about this a lot in Shark Tank as well. It doesn't have to be just the software, but everybody with a business is trying to acquire a customer. And that involves a cost as well, right? It might be advertising, whatever it is. Like, so you're trying to acquire a customer, there's a cost of acquiring that customer.
Yeah, typically like everything you invest in marketing plus even your sales team needs to spend a lot of time talking to customers, handling their objections, all of that, right? Those all go into the acquisition costs.
Yep. And then you acquire that customer and then, you know, there's some stuff that happens in the middle that I'll skip through for a second, but you acquire the customer, they've now got the deal with you. That's part of your annual recurring revenue, right? So, mm-hmm. And then you've got those metrics we talked about earlier where you're looking at, and there's many metrics that show that your customer is healthy, but like usage is obviously like number one, that they're actually using your product. And then you come up to that renewal, let's say, you know, we're talking about annual recurring revenue. So after a year of having your product, you're up for the renewal, right? If your customer renews at the same amount that they paid for that first year, that's what we call a flat renewal. If they add more licenses or buy add-ons or whatever, then you've grown the amount of ARR that you're getting from that customer. Yeah. But I want to make one point very clear. That's assuming that the things that they bought on, if they expanded is what we call it, this was an expansion, mm-hmm. that means that they're paying more in ARR. So maybe they bought more seats. That's the simplest yep. example. Now, this does not mean, let's say that they buy a professional services engagement, that which is a one-time fee. So that they pay like 20 grand to have somebody come on and do a two-week onboarding sequence with them or like engagement with them. That is not part of annual recurring revenue because it does not recur. Right? It's a one-time cost. Yep. It's set up with the tool. That's very common. And that's not part of ARR. But let's say that they bought more licenses. That counts as an expansion. If they renewed flat, so if they were...
The main point being like it's ARR if the customer is going to keep paying it unless they do something otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like if they, you know, if last year they paid $100 for your software and this year they're paying $100 for your software, that's a flat renewal, even if this year they added $20 on top of it to get professional services to do onboarding.
Okay. Yeah. And that's important because like that's the economic model of SaaS. That's why investors like SaaS because yeah. unlike on-premise software or unlike selling Windows CDs, well, that's probably not a good example. Like on-premise software where you have to like go and do an implementation every time, you have to go and do the training every time, right? There yeah. are a ton of one-time costs associated with that. The point of SaaS software is it's always on. The customer is going to continue paying for it.
Yeah.
Unless they stop finding a reason to pay for it.
Yep. Okay. So that's like the flat renewal or expansion scenario. Now let's say
yep.
it was $100, you know, but they decided, yeah, there's 20 people in my organization that aren't using it. So we're only going to pay $80. Let's say that's a contraction or what was the term mm-hmm. that you used?
Downsell.
So that's what happened this cycle. And then there's full churn where they're like, you know what? We don't really like your product or price or whatever, yeah. whatever. So we're
you
not.
You might hear that called a logo churn as well.
Yeah, a logo. Because
sometimes we talk about like the customer's entire company is a logo, right? You don't get to use their logo anymore because the entire company has left.
The entire company, yeah. So then that's a full churn. So all of this, so there's multiple things that we look at when we talk about retaining the customer. And you just saw us walk through a bunch of scenarios where we retained the customer either fully. We expanded with them, we contracted with them, or we churned, right? Those are the various mm-hmm. ones. So there's a metric that we look at usually at the end of every quarter called gross revenue retention or GRR. And it essentially measures like how much revenue is retained from your existing customers. Mm-hmm. But it excludes the expansion revenue. And the reason for that is because you want to see what you originally sold was retained. Because remember, like your cost of acquiring yep. the customer and like doing all of those activities led to that revenue to begin with. So you want to see how efficient you are as a business and like how much of that thing that you sold was retained, right?
It's also important because you don't want to be in a situation where on paper, the amount of revenue you have is going up, but it's because you upsold the customer into yeah. a bunch of things. And then they were also, or like you upsold a certain set of customers and then a bunch of other ones churned or partially churned or downsold or contracted or whatever, because yeah. that will still make your net retention, yeah. which do we talk about that yet?
Maybe
you're good. Okay. So like gross retention, like keeps you honest, at least on like, regardless of whether you made up for that churn somewhere else, how did you do just based on the customers that you actually sold in terms yep. of keeping them around.
Yep. And now let's talk about the other type of retention acronym, which is when you, which is NRR. Do you want to take us through NRR?
Yeah. So that's net, right? Net revenue retention. And with it's gross and net in general, right? Like that's how gross and net works. You might hear it called net dollar retention. You might hear it called net revenue retention, especially for those of us outside of the US. We use different currencies. We don't like saying dollar either. But it includes all of the expansions. It includes all the upsells and cross sells. It includes the downsells. It includes the churn. It basically says, like, after all of that stuff has happened, of the $100 that you had at the beginning, how much are customers paying you now? So again, that could reflect, it could be pretty close to GRR in some cases. But in a lot of cases, it's not going to be, because it wasn't just that your customers churned or didn't. It also might be the customers found value in a different part of your product and expanded.
Yep. Yep. So we do look at those two numbers, but it's a good way to keep everybody honest, as Adam said earlier, right? Because again, you don't want to like cover up the fact that you might have a leaky bucket somewhere, just by having an efficient sales machine that's like, you know, band-aiding over that by saying, well, okay, like, you know, 20% or 30% of everything I'm selling is churning completely, but I'm selling more. So, you know, like you can, so you want to look at both those numbers to understand the health of your business and also, you know, what's happening with your existing base, because also you want to sell to the people that are already your customers. Like when you have additional products or you have add-ons and things like that, like your actual existing base is where you're going to get a ton more value.
And like happy customers are way easier to sell to because they already see the value in your product than like going out and acquiring a bunch of new customers. There's an episode of The Office where Ryan the temp explains this to Michael Scott because he learned it in business school. And Michael's like, oh, we should expand our current customers. That's a really good idea.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. We'll have to find that clip actually.
Maybe we can insert it and not get copyright claimed.
I know.
But yeah, that's the main idea. And Dee, you've talked a lot about the idea of it being expensive to acquire new customers because you have to go do all your marketing. You have to do all your sales. Like that itself is also an acronym. It's called CAC, which is gross, but that's cost to acquire the customer. And then if you add up all of the renewals that we just talked about or churns, the point in SaaS, because the customer is always renewing, is that unlike with other software, you would pay like one really expensive amount upfront and then you would either buy the software again or not. With SaaS, you're typically going to pay a smaller amount, but keep paying it over and over, right? That's the idea of recurring revenue. And so what most businesses are looking to do in SaaS is find basically have enough successful renewals and expansions over time that we more than make up the amount of money that we spent to acquire them. So that's called lifetime value. And to the board, we would talk about the CAC to LTV ratio, basically making sure that over time we make way more money from our relationship with a happy customer than what it cost originally to acquire them.
Yep. Yep. Brilliantly laid out. Love that. Two that I want to ask Adam to tell us. So these are the ones that you're going to hear a lot, right? So a lot of what we just talked about were business metrics. It's like, okay, like how's our business doing? How do we actually know how customers are doing and how they're feeling outside of like adoption and some other things that we could talk about with health? There's like two major things that we look at to like tell us, okay, our customer's happy. One is called customer satisfaction score, which is CSAT.
CSAT.
And then the other one is net promoter score or NPS. And I know like we people debate these back and forth. We're not going to get into that, but just like straight up, Adam, what is CSAT? What is NPS?
Yeah, for sure. I might add a third one as well in a moment, but like, so for CSAT, you've seen CSAT, you've taken a CSAT survey. I guarantee you, you've taken it probably in the past week. It's like, how satisfied were you with your experience or how happy are you using this product? It's usually on a 1 to 5 or a 1 to 10 scale. And it's transactional typically, right? So like, it might not be your satisfaction with the overall product. It might be like, how well did this support interaction solve your problem? 1 to 5, 1 to 10, right? So that's, you're usually collecting that at a lot of different touch points, and it's pretty simple and pretty straightforward. But then NPS, I guarantee you, you've taken an NPS survey as well, especially if you've ever dealt with like a utility or phone or internet company. They love NPS. And this is a different question. It's basically asking, on a scale of 0 to 10, how likely are you to recommend this product And they usually say like to a colleague or like to a friend.
Yeah.
To a friend, yeah. Which is weird because then like half the responses you get as the vendor is like, I wouldn't recommend my HR software to a friend. But we're not going to go into the flaws in methodology. But like, this one is calculated a little bit differently because this is supposed to measure the overall relationship that a customer has with you and like how likely they are to be a promoter of your software. Do you want to talk about the breakdown in the scores just to break up the monotony here a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So in NPS, essentially what you look at are three types of responses or responders. It's promoters, people who are called passives, and then detractors. So promoters are the loyal people. They're the ones that are super enthusiastic. And so they're going to rate you out of 10, 9 or a 10. That's considered great. That's like what you want.
So like a raving fan.
Right. Your passives are satisfied, but they're not enthusiastic. They're kind of apathetic. They're like whatevs. And they're going to rate you like a 7 or an 8, which I think that's like an important thing to call out because I think in most other forms of surveys, people aim for 8 or above. But in an NPS, an 8's not really considered great, right? It's 9
or 10. So if you get one of those 0 to 10s and you don't want the rep you're talking to get in trouble, give them a 9.
Yeah, and don't grade this the way that you would grade in school. You know, if you're like, this test was a B interaction, I loved it. No, that's like not good, right? Like, it's like you want it.
Unless you're German or Dutch, in which case you'll do that anyway.
Yeah, I know, right? That's the thing. And so, okay, so again, promoters, 9 or 10 out of 10, passive, 7 or 8. Your detractors are 0 to 6. So anything below 7 is a death. So these are your customers who are unhappy. And I think the idea here is also that these are folks that may not say great things about you when it comes to word of mouth. Yeah. So that's why it's like such a broad range.
Yeah. And it's intentionally weighted towards like most of the range of scores they could give you actually being pretty bad for you because it encourages you to set a high standard.
Yeah.
And that's also how the rating works. So when you hear like someone's then NPS score, the score is actually going to work like based on the zeros to tens that they gave you individually. When you add all of that up, basically what is the ratio of promoters to detractors? So again, we're being pretty aggressive here because we're looking at like the number of nines and tens versus the number of people who gave you anything between 0 to 6. So ultimately then your score can range from a negative 100, which would mean that everyone who rated you gave you a 0 through a 6, to a 100, which means that everyone gave you a 9 or a 10. And most people don't have either of those. They have something in the middle, but it should put things in perspective because like it means that you could have a negative number NPS if most customers are like, you know, kind of even negative about you.
Yeah.
It means that 0, even though 0 sounds like a terrible score, kind of means like you have the same amount of promoters and detractors.
Yeah.
So you at least want to be above that.
Yeah.
And then if you're getting into like a lot of companies shoot for like 30 or 40 or something like that, because that actually means like, yeah, you have like a pretty healthy ratio of promoters to detractors.
Yeah. And I think like another thing that I'll point out is like people internally also use NPS. So like for employee satisfaction, people use NPS. And so a lot of times, like if you're not in customer experience, you may not hear of this even if you're in SaaS, but you'll get like a employee survey and you'll find out like what your department or your team or whatever's like ENPS was. And like sometimes I've heard people who are new to SaaS, like they'll be like, oh, I saw this ENPS thing and we got, you know, like a 52. That sounds horrible. That's like a failing grade when you think about like a D in school is like 65 and anything below a 65 is an F. No, like a 50 something.
Yeah. Like a D on a podcast, that's 100.
That's 100 always, man. But yeah, so it's like an ENPS or your NPS for your product is like in the 50s. That's not a bad thing in the score as far as that's concerned. Okay, so I think we got there. You said you were going to introduce the third one.
Oh yeah, the third one, because like NPS is really widely used, but it's also kind of a proprietary metric. There was it's from what the corporate executive board, I think, is the one who Bain or McKinsey. I don't know. Some consulting firm made this up. Yeah. There's a similar one like that. You're right. It's a consulting firm. There's a different methodology that you see used in customer service specifically from time to time, which is called Customer Effort Score or CES. And that's asking a different question. It's asking usually on a scale of 1 to 5, how easy was it for you to get an answer to your question? And so for those of us who are working in like scale digital self-service, like you'll see CES pop up sometimes instead of or in addition to the other ones we just talked about.
Yeah. Cool. So those are kind of the main SaaS terms. I know we wanted to keep this one short, Adam. So I'm going to fly us through a couple more things and we'll get to some tips and then we'll wrap up.
Let's do it.
But let's talk about some of the things you and I mentioned a lot in this podcast, things that have happened over the last like 5 years, I think.
Yeah.
Prominent. So I want to talk about zero interest rate policy, which I'm going to punt to you. I think that's like a good one for Adam. And then we're going to talk about product-led growth, sales-led growth, and what those things are. Because if you're going to be coming into SaaS, you're going to hear PLG and SLG a lot.
Yeah, and that's definitely your bag. Would love to hear your take on those.
Yep. And then I think and before we jump into those three, I'll just say if you hear the term go-to-market, that is like a collective. That's like the function that customer experience is in. It's like let's call it the department, right? So if CX is a function, then go-to-market is a department. It's a collective term that essentially talks about marketing, sales, customer experience, this other team that you may not have heard of outside of SaaS called RevOps, which is really an operations team that supports this entire cycle of like getting, acquiring the customer, getting that annual revenue, managing the renewals, churn, et cetera, et cetera.
And so if we say GTM,
That's
GTM is go to market.
So and that includes all those functions. Okay.
Yeah.
So,
you're right. That is like a weird SaaS term.
Yeah. It's a weird SaaS term, but most people haven't heard of it. So, all right. So that's go to market GTM. Now tell us, Adam, tell us about zero interest rate policy and why that matters.
We talk about ZIRP a lot on this podcast, and that's also because like, that's a thing that has happened, recently, which is that for a lot, at least for, for people who've had roughly the types of careers that Dee and I have had, basically from the Great Recession onward, we have been in a state where the US and to some extent, let's say the global economy as well, has basically been able to offer loans and money in general at very low interest rates. And you'll notice this personally if you tried to open a bank account in, 2010 or 2013 or something like that, and they were offering you like a rate of 0.6% or something like that, when even a few years ago before the Great Recession or during the Great Recession even, they were offering like 6.2% or something like that. So generally there's like a relationship between the interest rate that you're able to get when you open a bank account, the interest rate that you would pay when you would, buy a home or an auto loan or something like that. When interest rates are high, it's hard to borrow money. When interest rates are low, it's easy to borrow money. And as it turns out, it works the exact same way for businesses. So when the central bank says interest rates are really low and it's easy to borrow money, it's also easier for businesses to do fundraising. Because the point basically is to drive more economic activity. They want people borrowing money. They want people investing. And so businesses do that. And they raise more fundraising rounds and they go public earlier and they make wilder investments. And that's why for the early aughts and then in the 2010s again, there were these large periods where companies were not really trying to be profitable and sustainable. They were trying to pursue growth at all costs because they could get money really easily. So that whole period is what we call the ZIRP era, the zero interest rate policy era. And now we're not in that world anymore. There's much higher interest rates on things. It's harder to borrow, which is why you see less fundraising and why you see more layoffs, more companies trying to control their costs, more companies trying to be profitable. Is that about sum that one up, Dee?
I mean, that was a masterclass. I mean, it was like a Saturday school, I think.
Okay, well, now I want your Saturday school on PLG and SLG because, this is your world.
Yes. Okay. So, people are going to hear these two terms quite a lot. They're not meant to be adversarial. The ideal is you want to have both of these things going as a part of your business model at once. But a lot of the news in the media have pitted these two sort of business models against each other. So PLG, product-led growth, is essentially a go-to-market strategy where the product itself is driving, acquiring the customer, expanding the customer's usage of your product, you know, converting them into a paid customer, and then retaining them. So what that typically looks and feels like is that you as a user will start using a freemium version of a product, or you'll do a free trial or something like that.
What does freemium mean?
Freemium means that you have like a subscription model that, I mean, it's free, which is for free, and you're getting all the value without paying for it. And that's really the concept for PLG. It's like they want to give you value first before you pay. Right. Yeah. So think about it at a restaurant, really, right? Like you get the food and then you pay at the end. There are some restaurants where you pay upfront, and that's essentially like the sales-led growth model, right? Where the sales teams are having direct outreach conversations with customers. They're demoing the product, they're negotiating, they're closing the deal, and then the user starts to use the product, right? And then you come up to the renewal. So I think those are the two things. The other things about PLG that I will call out are that PLG is really focused on, because again, the point is the product should drive the growth, right? They're really focused on these things called growth loops. And so a growth loop, and this is typically where PLG teams spend a ton of time, product teams spend a ton of time, and I'll just read this from Reforge, but a growth loop is a self-reinforcing system that drives sustainable growth by attracting, engaging, and retaining users. So an example of a growth loop would be like, say that you are a user in Dropbox, you know, you might get more storage when you invite a couple of friends, you'll get additional storage from that, like free amount of storage that you got, right? You know, maybe commenting on a Miro board is it's a viral growth loop, because when you comment, then the other users are going to comment back. You're having that collaborative conversation in a board, and more people can do it. Slack Connect.
Yeah, joining a free Slack channel. You Slack Connect with someone else. Now you've got like people communicating with you in Slack. Yeah. It makes things stickier. Stickier is the term that's often used here.
Stickier, yep. And essentially you create this like flywheel of usage that comes from the features inside the product and the collaborative kind of expansion inside the product. Although I will say there's like a ton of argument about this where people say it's not like sales-led growth models don't do this, right? Obviously a proof of concept being a way that you do this. But again, those tend to be more controlled. They're still driven by sales. There's still something that takes quite a lot. Like it takes the user, I think, like time to actually get in and try the product. Whereas in PLG, it's immediate. And the contract is driven by a user. It's like more bottoms up than it is top down.
I think that's the key difference between PLG and SLG, right? Is like, is it a user? Is the expectation that a user is going to buy it first, and then you're kind of going to like expand from there into the organization or to more people? Or is it an organization buying where the expectation is like, upfront, we're going to make the investment. It's probably going to be more complex. So it doesn't really make sense for just like some random person to be using it on their own to get value.
Right. And then I think it should be both in most companies where you've got that. And in some companies, you're not really going to be able to do PLG, right? If you're, I don't know, like you're a compliance, you know, vendor or something, or you're somebody in finance, or like maybe you're in HR and you're really dealing with the folks that are managing those systems, like you're not going to have a ton of PLG bottoms up end user usage, right? You're probably going to be focusing on SLG, but in a space like, you know, maybe in something like Miro, where you are both end user and like, you know, you're looking at it like all the layers in an organization. It's like you want both. You're doing the top down and you're doing
the bottom. Like at Slack, we did both as well, right? You would have organizations where like IBM would say, hey, we want everyone to use Slack, and we are going to onboard these business units, and we are going to go wall to wall and have all of our business units on it, and we need to design these use cases, and we're going to sign a big contract. But then, of course, like we had tons of people who were just coming in and saying like, hey, we're starting this for our team and we're going to use the free product for at first, but oh, we like it. Now we're going to upgrade.
Right. A lot of Atlassian products, right? Your Notions to your Looms, like all these other products.
Figma.
A lot of Adobe products. Like, so these are some of the examples, but those are two pretty common terms that folks should be aware of. Let's see.
Yeah, really good. We talk about this a lot on the show, so that's helpful.
A lot on the show. Okay. I think we're kind of a little bit at time with terminology. We will have another episode where we'll talk a lot more about like AI terms and things like that folks should be familiar with.
Yeah, but there's tons more we can talk about.
Tons more, but I think these are like the big ones in SaaS. I would love to actually finish the episode, Adam, by asking you, like, what are some tips for somebody who's considering transitioning into this industry? Like, what might be, not necessarily like a tip, but like, what do you think is something different that they should know about SaaS, maybe than working in another industry or vertical?
I mean, if you're coming in as like an individual contributor, maybe if you're not coming in like as a leader of a team, like, because I think if you're coming in as a leader or like the expectations you're going to drive revenue or something like that, then there's like a whole different set of things that you need to know. But I think like the main thing that you need to know is that your business in SaaS kind of lives or dies by that renewal and by that expansion. So thinking about whatever your work does that ultimately drives those factors will help you, I think, figure out better where to focus. And even like, you know, I started out doing customer education in SaaS, and it was very different from the previous company I worked for, where I was doing customer education for like an on-prem company, because I was really thinking every day about what is it that we need to do to drive customer growth and remove customer friction. And that was almost the equation in my mind that would ultimately lead to that would lead to success. So I think that's like the mindset thing. The other thing I would say, whether you're like, maybe if you're a leader and you haven't worked in SaaS before and you're coming in, there is a course by Jay Nathan that's called Cover Your SaaS. And it's an onboarding basically into SaaS metrics, what your board thinks about, what your execs think about, especially if you're working in CX. It goes all into like gross margin, cost of goods sold, how that influences recurring revenue, like all the stuff that like we really need to think about once we're thinking about how to optimize our cost profile, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Cover Your SaaS by Jay Nathan is what I'd recommend. Dee, what about you?
And no, I love that recommendation. Such a good one. I think what I would say is you've probably heard the pace is different in SaaS. It's much faster. I think that in SaaS, we tend to do a lot of like inertia busting. So that's a little bit new. I know when I've worked for like government entities, nonprofits, and other types of businesses, there's a bit more of a reliable cadence and rhythm. And that does not exist in SaaS. So be prepared.
Never a dull moment in SaaS. No.
Never a dull moment. So I would say like our planning cycles and things like that are something to be a little bit mindful of. Like our fiscal years aren't going to be the same as calendar years. Like most companies in SaaS, I would say your first quarter. So we think of everything in quarters, and everyone's building a deck in SaaS, PowerPoint presentation of some kind, not in PowerPoint, usually anymore, but, so you're starting.
Now it's in Gamma. Everything's in Gamma these days.
Yeah. Or Miro. Hello. but people start in February 1st is pretty normal, from a fiscal year perspective. And so then you've got your quarter. So February, March, April, are Q1, and then so on and so forth. Right. So you're doing everything in quarters, your golden quarters. That's really what the cadence is in SaaS. So, you know, everything resets at the start of a quarter. End of quarters are always like very, very kind of harried and frenzied.
Yeah. You said OKRs, objectives and key results.
Yeah. Not
every quarter or annual.
Like the smaller SaaS companies, I think like we didn't do OKRs at Box, as an example, right? You did have goals though, right? You had like your targets. So that's another thing to know. And you really think a lot about like if the work that you're doing is going to lead to an outcome. It's like performative work is something that like we don't really like. And as managers that we try to root out really like to in SaaS, it's like, does this
We talk a lot about like outputs versus outcomes.
Yep, exactly.
Or like activity versus outcomes.
Yep. And I know that can be very challenging for folks. Like what I, you know, when I went into this from working at the state, there's also the concept of like overtime, even when you're fully salaried as a state person, like a person working for the state or the government, like you can say, oh, I worked overtime. So this is going into a bucket that you can use called flex time. Yeah, that does not exist in SaaS. you know, you're really, the schedule is very different. Teams are global. You're going to be on calls at like 8 p.m. Whereas like that certainly was not the case working for the state. It's just a little bit more chaotic in that way, but it's good to know.
You just reminded me of one more thing, actually, which is that, you know, like, especially for those of us who are in like education, community, like some of these areas where the core the core loop of the job or the core duties of the job or like helping people learn things or helping people use products. Like teachers and people who work in education can make great customer education people. They can make great customer instructional designers. They can make great CSMs, customer success managers, while we're doing acronyms. But it's not the same job. And I think if you are job hunting in SaaS, I think it's helpful to really, to like not hit it so hard on like, here are the things that I did in my job as a teacher or in government or like whatever you want to say, and like try to like make the argument that it's exactly the same as the role in SaaS, because that I think gives the hiring manager the impression that maybe you're being like a bit naive or you're overselling yourself or you have a blind spot. I think it's actually better to like really try to understand what the differences are between what you do today and how this would look in SaaS and how you would adapt or how you would build new skills so that you can go into those sort of roles.
Yeah, I love that. That's a whole episode that we could do too.
Oh, we'll hit that one for, we'll do a tight 45 on that one.
At some point. We'll have to. Yeah. Awesome. Well, we hope that was really helpful. If you're considering a career in SaaS, it's definitely very rewarding. Highly recommend it. It's not without its challenges, but also that's kind of what makes it fun, is you do get to solve really cool problems and help people with challenges that they're having.
Yep.
So I love SaaS. Adam loves SaaS.
We love SaaS.
And we hope you found this helpful. Adam, wrap it up for us. How can people
engage
with us in this episode?
We will post on our LinkedIn. We will ask other folks in our network to contribute and tell us what they would want you to know about SaaS. I think we could make this a little bit of a love fest and share everyone's collective knowledge, because we got some real old heads, and I say that in the kindest possible way. We're old heads.
We are old heads, yes. Awesome. And if you found this episode of value, please like and subscribe to us on wherever you get your podcast. We'd love a 5-star review. We'd love comments. You know, we're doing this for you guys, so we love feedback.
Yes, please do. Thanks, Alan Coda, for the music that is probably playing right now once I edit this.
Yeah.
And to our listeners, see you around the way.
You can't stop.
I don't know. I don't have a sign off for this show. I don't.
A swear jar for you at this point.
I need it. Okay. Can we crowdsource a sign off for me, please?
Oh my gosh, yes. Take a shot every time Adam says.
No, like someone. Okay. Like we're gonna have a contest. We'll have a caption contest. Give me a new sign off, and then we'll use that.
Yes, caption contest.
We have a group of people on LinkedIn who are monitoring the continuity of our episodes. Actually, what they're doing is they're like looking at the like how much wine I have in my glass.
Who's doing
they're commenting, that? They're commenting that it's like higher later in the episode than it is earlier in the episode. So it's evidence that we're editing.
Who did that?
On LinkedIn right now. Type in CX etc. wine truthers.
Are you joking?
Yes, I'm joking.
I was like, what are you doing? Wine truthers. You do need to have, when we're famous, you'll have to switch from a glass to like a opaque, the like reality TV editor.
Oh, it's reality. Yeah. It's like the Love is Blind giant pours of wine, yeah, right?
Exactly. Like I think it was like the beach one that everyone was into. I actually got into that show one year too. Mm-hmm. What was it called? Love Island.
Love Island. Yeah.
Oh my
and
God.
And then there was Cougar Town, right? Where they always had giant glasses of wine because they were like wine moms because they were cougars.
I get it. It's the tired old, you know, women of a certain age love a white wine trope.
Exactly. Listen, if I wanted to drink wine and see cougars, I'd be playing Red Dead Redemption right now.
That's right.